From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's decision to revoke the semi-autonomous rule of its northernmost state of Kashmir has been met with widespread denunciation. Kashmir has been at the center of long simmering tensions and even wars between India and Pakistan for decades, going all the way back to the end of British colonization. But Modi's right-wing Hindu nationalist government has inflamed tensions at a time when both India and Pakistan are nuclear-armed states. While Indian troops have long occupied the majority Muslim state of Kashmir, thousands more troops have been sent to quell anger and enforce a curfew. My guest is Waqas Syed, National Coordinator for the North American Indian Muslim Association and the California State Coordinator for ICNA Council for Social Justice. Welcome to the program, Waqas.
Thank you for having me here, Sonali.
So let's first put the issue of Kashmir into historical context, because those who support Modi might simply say to people unfamiliar with the situation, if Kashmir is indeed a state in India, what's the problem with allowing the Indian central government to rule over it like it rules over all other states? Can you give us a brief historical framework for why Modi's action is so problematic?
One of the most important basis that this statement ignores is the agreement in 1948 with the people of Kashmir, and the leadership of Kashmir, that was to allow Kashmir to have a relationship with India based on autonomy. It was agreed by the Indian government to have a prime minister in Kashmir, and the defense and foreign policy would be handled by India. And this agreement was signed and ratified by Pakistan, by India, by the people of Kashmir at that time. And this agreement is completely ignored. What else is also ignored when saying that Kashmir is an integral part of India is the United Nations resolutions. There are not one, not two, but three separate resolutions which call for self-determination, or in other words, plebiscite of the people of Kashmir. And no situation, no matter what the Indian government says or even the Pakistani government says, would have that kind of legitimacy without the input of the Kashmiri people themselves. And that is the fundamental idea, or the fundamental fact on the ground, that is ignored by everybody who are at the table. And another thing that also is ignored is the Tashkent Agreement between Pakistan and India right after the war between Pakistan and India over Kashmir, which called for the withdrawal of the armed forces of both Pakistan and India from Kashmir, and again to have a plebiscite to find out what the people of Kashmir really want. Either they want to join Pakistan or India or be an independent country. None of these agreements or international understandings with including the United Nations and the international community are taken into account when this blanket statement is made that Kashmir is part of India and we can have any kind of law or any kind of administrative actions on Kashmir as we, which is the Indian government, see fit.
Right. So the end of British rule in 1947 sort of was the beginning of the tensions around Kashmir, which is a state of more than 12 million people, about 70% of the population Muslim, about 30% Hindu and other minorities, but mostly the minority is Hindu. And there has been, as you said, there have been repeated attempts at by the population of Kashmir Kashmir to protect themselves from the armies of both these very powerful nations. Is this revocation of Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, which is the article that you were referring to, is Modi's revocation of this article part of his ongoing persecution of Muslims in India as a, you know, head of a right-wing Hindu nationalist government?
Exactly. As an Indian Muslim or a minority in the country of India, we have these issues. We had the issue of Kashmir, a political issue, issue of implementing international agreements, and the persecution of minorities, persecution of the Muslim minority, the Muslim or the Christian minority, the lower caste Hindus, and so on. What this government has done, which belongs to a right-wing movement that is over 100 years ago, which includes the assassin of Mahatma Gandhi as one of its followers, has done is merge these issues. And let me try to explain how it has done that. There is a similar article, Article 235A and 370, where people outside of that particular state or that region cannot buy property or own businesses. That is currently exists for the state of Himachal Pradesh. That currently exists for the northeastern states. And it is not that Kashmir is the only exception where Indians cannot buy property. So when you see this kind of a discrimination, another example is the state of the princely state of Junagadh, which is Hindu majority, and the ruler or the Sultan of that was Muslim. And he decided at the partition to join Pakistan, but India did not agree, saying that the population is majority Hindu, so it should join India. And it was forcibly taken with army action in Junagadh, which is currently part of the state of Rajasthan. Now, when you see this kind of direct discrimination or different treatment, it gives you an idea of what this Hindu government is going after, which is primarily to turn a secular Indian democracy into a theocracy, a right-wing Hindu theocracy where every citizen is first class unless he's a non-Hindu, he or she is a non-Hindu.
Just to underscore, when you say Muslim minority, although Muslims are a minority in India, because it's such a large country, we're talking about 200 million people. There are 200 million Muslims in India, you know, which is what, more than two-thirds of the population of the entire United States. We're talking about the country with the second largest Muslim population in the world. So even though it is a minority within India, the actual numbers are a huge, huge number. It's a huge population.
Yes, and it's even more mind-boggling how such a large population can be delegitimized, do not have political representatives, are much behind economically, socially, politically than any other minority. And the Satar Committee report of about 15 years ago has confirmed this. And over a period of discrimination, how such a large, such a huge minority has become totally politically powerless. If you see today in the parliament and the state assemblies, Muslims have lowest participation they ever had in history. And this is the kind of delegitimization of an entire population that is going on day in and day out in so many fronts, whether it's social, economic, political, military, police, everything. And this is the kind of steps that are happening in the last 20 to 30 years that lead towards a country that has the Hindu right-wing ruling class, and then has the second class, or even the third, or probably the fourth class of other minorities, unless you or the Indian Muslims accept the Hindu supremacy. And we see that Kashmir is a very clear example today, where you have leaders within the BJP. These are not party workers.
That's the ruling party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, Modi's party, BJP.
Exactly, the Janata Party, which is the political arm of the Rashtriya Swayamsevak, which is the RSS, which is a more than 100-year-old movement, a Hindu right-wing movement. And the political arm, the BJP, and their leadership, including the chief minister, of Haryana, has called for Hindu men to go to Kashmir and get married to Kashmiri women, and to buy plots there, to start businesses there, to basically change the demographic.
So like, and a settler colonial mentality, basically.
Absolutely. And that's what the repealing of Article 370 and 35A has done. It has turned Kashmir overnight into an occupied territory, from a semi-autonomous disputed region to an occupied land by India, with the world's largest density of armed people to the civilian population. I think they have brought in close to 200,000 more people in addition to the, not people, the armed forces, in addition to the 700,000 that are already there for such a small region. And that shows the complete militarization, the appeal to non-Muslims to leave Kashmir, the closing of the borders, not allowing anyone to go in or out, not allowing media to report or even go inside, not allowing even Kashmiris who hold U.S. Nationality, citizenship, to leave. These are the kind of steps that is so concerning, and that points towards more violence and points towards the intention of the current government to seal Kashmir and to hide their agenda, you know, which is to convert or the change demography of Kashmir, to completely take away any option where the Kashmiris' will, the Kashmiris' self-determination, can be a factor in future negotiations.
And just to give our audience an idea of the density of troops, as you were just referring, which is another reason why the story is so significant, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of troops in a small region. And as a comparison, the U.S. currently has something like 10 to 13,000 troops in Afghanistan, a country that is actively fighting a war in an entire country. So in this very tiny region of the planet, you have hundreds of thousands of troops. Can you tell me what has been happening in Kashmir since the revocation of Article 370, since India sent even more troops there? I understand there's a communications blackout and a curfew, so it may not even be possible for us to know necessarily what's happening inside Kashmir. But from what you can tell, what is the state, how have people living in the state been treated, and how have they been reacting?
Immediately before the announcements, probably minutes or even hours before the announcement of the repeal of these articles, internet was shut down for the entire region. Phone lines were shut down. The border was strengthened with more forces. About 35,000 forces had already entered the state, in addition to the 700,000 that are already there, to basically seal the border. All non-Muslims, especially the Hindus that were there to perform the pilgrimage of Amarnath, and they were asked to cut short their pilgrimage and leave. And these were some of the steps. And most importantly, the entire leadership of over 100 people were put into house arrest.
This is the government leadership of the state of Kashmir.
Yes, these were the community leadership because there is no real elections. There is no, so there are organizations, that, different organizations who are the leadership. And because of the continuous allegation that Kashmiris are disunited, they do not have a proper leadership, we have something called the Hurriyat Conference, where all the leadership of Kashmir have come together and have formed a conference to negotiate on behalf of the Kashmiri people. So there is a voice. And by curtailing this voice, including the Congress and the other political leadership that were elected by elections conducted by India, so these were put on in-house arrest as well. And these people could not reach out to their followers. They could not use phones. They could not use internet. They just had to stay in. And yesterday was the most religiously significant day for Muslims. It was the Eid. It was right after the Hajj. And there was very nominal relaxation of certain regulations, especially the curfew, but it was immediately brought back. So on Sunday, which was the day of Eid, the curfew was relaxed just a little bit for the Kashmiris to celebrate, which was the most important day in the Muslim calendar. However, the leaders are still under house arrest. Syed Shah Jilani, which is one of the most well-known leader, was actually arrested. He was taken from his home. And this kind of curtailing of the voice of the Kashmiri is something of very, very profound effect on the whole situation. More than the curfews, more than shutting off the internet or the phone calls, and the media. Over the past few years, the entire media of the country has become more, has been facing more and more pressure from the government, especially those that are independent media. There are very few independent media in the country remaining. And on top of that, no matter what media was in the valley of Kashmir, they have been asked to leave. And on Saturday, there was a protest by Kashmiris, which was put down with guns and gas, but there were no known casualties. And when there was a BBC reporter who actually videotaped the whole protest, and the Indian government flatly denied of it ever happening, that shows that the government is confident of covering up whatever happens in the valley. And that is very, very concerning from what's going to happen in the near future. We are very afraid and we are very scared for the people there based on these actions by the government.
And are journalists being allowed in at all? Are people trying to get information? And presumably there are journalists in Kashmir who are even Kashmiri who might be documenting what's happening, may not be able to get their reports out. But what's the state of journalism and reporting from the region?
Absolutely none. All what we hear from are from people or journalists or volunteers who are secretly taping or recording or covering what's happening on the ground. And if we have no idea of what's happening on the ground, we just have only the official government statements to go by. So the only mainstream or the media that we have seen in the last few days is that report I just mentioned by the BBC.
Now, let's talk about the broader international implications of this. The Pakistani government has, of course, reacted with anger and disappointment at what India has done. And of course, as I mentioned, both are nuclear-armed states. India and Pakistan have gone to war twice before over tensions in Kashmir. How serious is the potential for a third war, which, of course, is far higher stakes than ever before, given that both are now nuclear armed states?
Yes. Considering the nuclear situation with both Pakistan and India, the situation is no longer how it was in 1971 or 1963 or even 1948. This war is definitely has far more higher stakes. It's not just the nuclear ability of both the nations, but also so much time and so much persecution has gone through, and most importantly, the rise of the Hindu right-wing government in India. So this is a very important factor. This government, we have seen in the last few years, can go to any extent to just at least show that they are strong, they can do things. We have seen their raids in Pakistan during the elections, just to appear strong and taking some action. And even though it did not achieve anything, it did bring in a lot of political success for the government or for the BJP at that time, which resulted in a massive electoral victory for the BJP. So these are the new situations that make that future conflict all the more dangerous, all the more long-term, and far more critical to be resolved than before. One of the important things for the international community is the insistence of India that it is a bilateral issue, or if now, as the BJP is mentioning, it is an internal issue, and not welcoming any type of mediation, be it from the United States, United Nations, any other country, to resolve this. Because any kind of negotiation starts with the premise of implementation of agreements that India is already party to, and India does not want to do that.
Now, we just have a couple of minutes left. I have a couple more questions for you. One is, could this situation derail peace developments in Afghanistan? Because the U.S. has just negotiated or attempted to negotiate a peace deal with the Taliban in Afghanistan, which requires Pakistani participation. But Pakistan has said it needs to move a lot more of its troops potentially to its southern border, away from its northern border with Afghanistan, which some are suggesting could jeopardize what's happening in Afghanistan. Do you have any information about that?
Yes. The Taliban has said it has nothing to do or will not get involved in the Kashmir conflict. It is focused in Afghanistan. So that is a kind of good news for the United States. And the United States can continue to do its towards its objective of withdrawal from Afghanistan. However, when we see the desperation of Pakistan in bringing this issue to a resolution and in getting other parties involved, it is likely that Pakistan is going to play the card with the United States that to get its cooperation on the Afghan front, it needs some type of help from the United States on the Kashmiri front, on the Eastern front.
Right.
This is a card that is very much possible that Pakistan.
And then finally, what about legal challenges to what India has done within India? Those who are not just among Muslim lawmakers and or organizations, but even some of the left-wing and progressive parties and organizations in India have vowed to fight what Modi has done. Are there legal challenges given that in doing what he has done, Modi has gone against the Indian Constitution? There seems to be a legal case that is to be made here.
Yes, there are attempts, there are attempts. But as we have seen during the elections, the whole controversy of EVM, which is the electronic voting machine, there have been proven meddling of these machines by the government. Many of these cases have gone to the courts. And with that, we see that this government will go to any extent, including right before a report going to come out by the Central Bureau of Investigation, which is the internal investigation arm that was investigating a corrupt deal by the government. And overnight, the entire offices were locked down and the entire staff was arrested by the government.
Wow.
And this happened right under the watch of this government. It happened probably a couple of years ago. So anything can be expected. So reliance on institutions of court and of law and order are is you know as much as we can hope for that it will be strong, but we don't think that we cannot rely a lot on these things. As we have seen, there's a super majority of the party in the parliament, and they are confident they can get this change in constitution going right. as they feel fit.
Well, Waqas, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and helping to shed light on these on the situation. Can you give out a website for where people can find out more about the work you do?
Absolutely. It's www.icna, CSJ, ICNA Council for Social Justice. And we also have a Facebook for the North American Islamic Indian Muslim Association, NAIMA, facebook.com/IndianMuslims.org.
Well, we'll post a link to all of those from our website. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali.
Waqas Syed is National Coordinator for the North American Indian Muslim Association and the California State Coordinator for ICNA Council for Social Justice. ICNA.org is the website. We've been discussing the situation in Kashmir. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now Spotify.